Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, this week I am pleased to welcome Lulu Wong, director and writer of The Farewell, a film about a Chinese and Chinese-American family that come together in China under the guise of a fake wedding to say goodbye to their beloved matriarch, the only person at the wedding who doesn't know she has a few weeks to live. And the crazy thing is, it's a true story. It's all based on Lulu's real life, and it's fantastic. And it's a film in which food plays an integral role when the family is gathering around the table and sort of dealing with this very challenging situation they have concocted. Oh, also joining us on the pod is our ace staff photographer, Alex Lau, whose parents immigrated from China, and he deeply loved the film, and it really resonated with him. After that, I sit down with Healthy-ish editor Amanda Shapiro to check in on the Farmers Market Challenge. It's 1 month to cook 10 beautiful recipes, each centered around an all-star piece of summer produce, and we're about halfway through this already, so hopefully this will inspire you to get in the kitchen. Now, let's do this. Here is Lulu Wong and Alex Lau. All right, Lulu Wong, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we have special guest, Alex Lau.
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
This is actually your first time on the podcast, Alex?
First time. Rookie debut.
Let's talk, because you're kind of the spark that sparked this podcast. We'd gotten pitched by Lulu's publicist for her to come on the pod, and we're looking into it. And then about a few days later, you Instagrammed about having seen the movie.
Yeah, I went to watch The Farewell. It was on my radar for the longest time, and saw it, loved it. Posted about it on Instagram. Adam, more often than not, uses our text messages as a stream of consciousness of whatever he's thinking to send to me. So, like, maybe, like, 2 hours after I posted that, it's like, legit? I'm like, super legit. Let's do it. And he's like, all right, then you're going to talk to Lulu next week. I'm like, okay, let's do it.
Get some questions ready.
I'm in.
In Alex's photography, you spent a lot of time documenting your elderly grandmother.
Sure.
Who lives in Queens?
Brooklyn,
okay. Yeah. And interesting, and obviously the film very much centers on your grandmother. Mm-hmm. There is a respect or a sort of how the elderly are sort of viewed and treated in that culture compared to maybe some American cultures. And curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the matriarch, the grandmother is the matriarch in a lot of families. And also, you know, with the world changing and globalizing, I think the grandmother is really the central person who brings everyone together, and in many ways is like trying to hold it down, because as generations are younger and they move away from home, they are less concerned with coming together with the family. They want to go pursue their own dreams and independence and blah, blah, blah. And so I think, at least in my family and a lot of my friends' families, grandma's the one that's like, guys, like, come home, you know, like, do you see your brother enough? Are you guys, you know, have you checked in with him? Are you calling your mother enough? Make sure you call your mother, you know, things like that.
It's the same way. Yeah, my grandmother's older. I think she's just turned 90. She's not doing great health-wise, but she is you're right, she gravitates the family and grounds us, even though we're not all in the same place. But if it's her birthday or if she's not doing well, then the family immediately comes into the little home in Sunset Park. So when I saw the scenes in The Farewell, where everybody just flies to China and just meets up and sits over a meal, I'm like, wow, this is real life, yeah.
I was watching the film, and it seems when your character, played by Awkwafina, goes back to China with the rest of the family to visit the grandmother, and so many of the family gatherings happen around the table, which mm-hmm. I think is consistent with a lot of cultures. Mm-hmm. But you didn't seem to... Food was what brought people together, but it wasn't like a film like Chef or something where food is really provocative, you know, mm-hmm. with like the crispiness and the crunching and all that sort of stuff. How did you sort of like approach food in the film in terms of being central to it but not overly delicious and, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a very sort of Western gaze it's probably specifically an American gaze to look at food, particularly ethnic food, in this very romanticized way. You know, it's like a very American thing to now be like a foodie.
Mm-hmm.
And if you went back to China and you were like trying to explain to the older Chinese generation, maybe even the younger generation, like what a foodie was, they would be so confused.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you eat food every day? Yeah, so do I.
Yeah, like you love food? Okay, you're human.
Yeah.
You're like, I eat everything and I'm just really into exploring all foods. And they would just be like, and?
Everybody
like,
does
everyone
that, yeah.
does that. That's just part of life. If you don't like food, what do you live for, you know? And it's so ingrained in the culture. And I wanted to capture that as a texture of the family and of life without elevating it beyond the other textures of life, you know, which is, you know, whether it's like walking, eating, like it's just, you go to the bathroom, like it's just part of everyday life. It's normal. And I think that to sort of fetishize it or exoticize it and do close-ups and really try to like point it out would do it a disservice. You know, it's a different gaze. It's,
yeah.
it's one that would be from an outsider's perspective. And also on top of that, it was important for me that food was a part of the story, and that food for me in the movie allowed me to like visualize the internal tension, like the lie, right? Because food symbolizes celebration and love, and it's an expression of love from grandma to feed you. And if you're coming home for a wedding, you're expected to, of course, celebrate by eating. But for the family, they're actually coming home to grieve. And when you're grieving, you lose your appetite. And so having food around all the time was a constant reminder that this is supposed to be a celebration. You're supposed to be eating. And how do you explain to grandma that you don't have an appetite and you don't want to eat? You can't. So you just, you swallow food along with the grief as part of this lie.
Yeah, there's that one scene where I don't think it was her mom or maybe the grandma. It's like literally forcing a pancake into her mouth, like, eat it. She's like, I don't want to eat this.
It looks really good.
Yeah.
It just wasn't the time or place for it. Yeah.
It's delicious. I ate many of them.
So, yeah, on set, how did that work on set? So, you someone obviously is making all the food to put on a table. You've got 10, 12 people around the table. There, the actors are actually eating the food, but they're doing various takes. Is the food hot? Are there leftovers for the crew afterwards? Like, how did, like, literally on set, how did that work?
Yeah, well, and every scene was different. Like, the meat pies, they started making them the day before and showing them to me. And, like, is this the right size? Like, how golden do you want them? And, you know?
Who is they, for
instance? Oh, so, like, the person who made the meat pies, for example, worked in the art department. And he was, I guess, chosen to be the one to do all the meat pies because he knew what they were and he knew how to make them, and so he made them. And you know, you need a certain amount of oil. If it's too hot, then it turns really, you know, it gets burnt. And so, you know, it's the right amount of oil and the skin and the meat and everything, right? So he made a bunch of them to show me, and I was like, well, I gotta taste them.
Quality
to make
control.
Sure, yeah, quality control, to make sure they're accurate. And I just remember eating meat pies. I was so sick of like the catered food by then, uh-huh. So I just ate meat pies like the entire day. And he's like, all right, now I gotta make more.
Because ate all of them?
Yeah, I ate all of them. So they, and I was like, you just gotta keep making them because I'm guaranteed they're gonna disappear.
So he did a good job.
He did a really good job. Okay. The meat pies were delicious. And then, like, you know, breakfast foods, we ordered a bunch of them because, you know, you do multiple takes, you have to replace them. And luckily, like, none of the actors were picky about what foods they ate. I feel like if I did a movie in Hollywood, people would be like,
oh,
I'm vegan. Can you do, like, a vegan?
Can
so
you
then
imagine?
You have to, like, imitate it, but, like, make it the vegan version.
Keto meat pancake.
Keto,
yeah,
vegan,
exactly.
Gluten-free. Every actor would have, like, a little check, like, a list of check things,
and it wouldn't,
you know,
look right, no. You know, if you, so, thank God, everybody there ate normal and just ate everything. But it was tricky when we got to the wedding banquet because we couldn't make all that food. And so it came out of the real kitchen of the banquet hall. You know, especially those crabs in the wedding banquet. It's a low budget film, indie film. I was told we only have enough money for 12 crabs. Wow. They were like, sorry, Lulu, but this is what I have. But my art director, my production designer, Yong Ok Lee, just like very like no nonsense person. She was like, I only have money for 12 crabs. That is all. So do not eat the crabs unless you have to tell me which shots we actually need the crab for. And because you don't want to break them apart. You can't put it back together. And so we were shooting over 4 days. And so we were trying to build the schedule around the crabs going bad. Because she's like, once you cook
12 crabs.
Yeah, she's like, once you cook, because you get fresh crabs, you get it in one shipment, and then they start to go bad. Once you cook it.
How much is, what kind of crabs were they, and how much was each?
They were just like large, I don't know what they were called in China, but like king crab, Dungeness crab. Uh-huh. But the banquet was expensive because you've got a lot of meat. There's a lot of dishes.
A lot of food.
A lot of food.
Part of it is like this notion of excess. If you're having a celebration, the point is
the mountain of
more than you can eat. And to celebrate. It's funny with the crabs. There's scenes like there are those explicit scenes where the camera seizes on the crabs coming out because there's the whole thing about crab versus lobster and what they can afford for the banquet.
And it's like it looks like there's like a million crabs, right? We were just very smart about it because we had to recycle the crabs for
amazing.
Like different shots. And then some of the crabs you can't eat because they paint it, like they put a thing on it to make it shiny and look better for the camera. So it was this whole thing of like, we've got 12, how many can you eat, how many can you not? And then we were getting this shot of Bao, the little boy.
I love that shot. Yeah. Bao like drinking out of the crab. I
think, he's like trying to break open the crab, right? And we shot him on like day four. I don't know if I should say this, but like the crabs had gone like really bad. I said, can you do that trick where you put a cookie in his mouth and then like put the crab behind your face so it looks like you're eating it, but you're actually just chewing the cookie? And we made him do it, but I don't think he was like, the crab looks really good. And I was like, don't eat the crab, Bao. Did someone tell him not to eat it?
That is hilarious. I'm curious, did you, while filming in China, did you allow any of your relatives on set, or were you worried that they might be correcting you, like, oh, no, that's not how we serve this, or that's not how we do this? And
no, I really wanted them to. Little Nai Nai in the movie is my real Little Nai Nai.
Oh. So good.
She's my real great aunt, and she plays herself.
That perm.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Oh,
that's her real hair.
Wow.
All of her costumes are her real clothes. and so I wanted her to be in the movie because she was the one who instigated the lie in real life. And I felt like nobody would bring more humanity to this character and this decision that she made more than her herself. And so I was always asking her, does this feel real? Does this feel the way that it, you know, like authentic to our family? And I tried to get others.
How old is she now?
I think she's 68 or something like that. That's my great aunt, not my nai-nai, not my grandma.
So you're asking a 68-year-old to appear in a feature film for the first time in her life and just like roll with it?
What a pro.
Yeah. She didn't want to do it at first because she was like, I'm a normal person. Yeah. I'm not an actress and I'm going to ruin your movie with my fat face. And I was like, no, your face is adorable. And of course, now she's like,
Star.
Yeah, now like she came to the red carpet in New York and she was like,
oh my God.
She was like, if this movie gets any awards, I'm flying myself out. And I want to go on the red carpet. She's like, what are you making next? Do you have a role for me? Like she's like so into it.
Did she pick her own outfits?
Well, we tried to pick outfits for her, my costume designer, but I was like, none of these clothes are as good as her own. Just go shop in her closet. And so that's what we did. We just said, bring your favorite outfits. And she like modeled them and then we, you know.
Yeah, I was trying to get a handle on, so a lot of the scenes are shot in the grandmother's apartment around the table and then the banquet. And there's always a lot of food. I never had a real sense of like, oh, is this family middle class, well-to-do? Like, how would you describe where your family fits in the socioeconomic scale in China?
Well, it's a communist country, so everyone's equal.
Yeah.
Equal opportunity in China. Everybody knows that.
But also, it's very subtly hinted at, but grandma was in the army, in the Red Army.
I love that photo in the back That last scene where you see the photo of
Yeah, that's my real grandmother and my real grandfather in the army.
Yeah. Wow. That was a really nice touch.
Thank you. Yeah. It's such a lovely way for me to honor them, to, you know, have them in that photo. But yeah, because my grandmother was in the army, she's more privileged. I wouldn't say she's wealthy, but, you know, she's comfortable. Mm. But still in a modest way.
Yeah.
And so it's different than like the States. It's like wealthy middle class. It's because like her apartment is from the government and things mm-hmm. like that, because she was in the army. But yeah, but I think there's still, because her background is that of somebody from a very poor family before she joined the army. And so the mentality is still, we can't look poor. You yep. know, like mm-hmm. when family is visiting, when we're celebrating, when we're putting on something like a celebration or an event for the family, to save face, you have to show off. You have to have everything in abundance.
Banquets. Yeah.
You have to have lobster yeah. over creme. Yeah. You know,
and the actual family was like, well, we don't want to spend this money on lobster because this wedding is kind of not a real wedding. And
yeah, yeah. And it's like, it's not that important. They're really there to see her. Yeah. They don't want her to, like, you know, go overboard with spending money and time and energy. Mm-hmm. But of course, for her, the most important thing is her only grandson's getting married. She needs to see.
I think
face.
He may be my favorite character, by the
his
way.
His hair is amazing.
His hair is amazing.
The cousin.
Oh my God. Face.
Yeah. The cousin. Yeah.
His
yeah.
facial expression. He had what, maybe two lines in the movie? So
unbelievable.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Alex Lau here is he's famous at Bon Appetit for many things, but one of them is his appetite. He's a nationally competitive power lifter, and he consumes many calories a day. So when you were growing up, mm-hmm. who was your grandmother the cook? Was it your mother? Who was doing the sort of the cooking in the family, and what were the meals like when you were growing up in New York and then San Francisco?
I mean, let me first off preface this by saying, when I saw Little Bao, that was me. When I was 6 years old, I think I was over 100 pounds.
You got to see that one photo of him, which we printed out, of him in a red Speedo on the beach with like a Pepsi and a bag of Cheetos.
Cherry Pepsi, Fritos, and a red Speedo and bowl cut on Jones Beach.
Oh my God, that's
literally weighing
amazing.
100 pounds.
Literally body by like barbecue Cantonese pork and like wontons and dim sum. It was amazing.
It was just waiting to be sculpted into muscle.
Yeah.
you are already like, playing, looking ahead.
That's like, are you an only child?
No, I'm the youngest, so it's
you're
basically
the
same. Yeah.
It's that, yeah. Because yeah. my uncle is the youngest, my mother's younger brother, and she would always joke that when he was little, he was like that too. Mm. Just so spoiled and like, here, have all the food that you want. And he would eat so many dumplings that until he would throw up, and then he would throw up, and then just keep eating. And he's like 10 years old,
sounds
and he
like
would
me.
Just
yeah,
eat like
for sure.
Sounds like college.
50 dumplings.
Yeah,
like, just keep going.
Yeah, so Lau, what was that in your household? Who was cooking? How
I mean,
often?
I feel like it's probably very similar. My mother did a lot of cooking. I don't like my grandmother didn't do a lot of cooking because she was very older. But it was my aunt, and my mother, and we'd have these giant feasts, and we always go to dim sum. But it's a very family-oriented thing. And that's what I really found so fascinating in The Farewell. I just felt like, yeah, the food is always delicious, but that's baseline. That's expected.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's always there.
It's always there. You're right. It's like a secondary character, and you can be sad, you can be stressful, like and still be eating this delicious food. And that's what I thought was really striking to me.
Is it all taken for granted? Like in America now, if you cook anything, you have to Instagram it and share it and let everyone know.
Yeah.
Cooking the food, like in the movie, it's like, that's a lot of work to cook all that food for that people. But it's almost on a daily basis. Like, oh yeah, we're going to have a good dinner with really good food. And that's just what we do here.
Yeah.
Do people appreciate the mom or the grandmother for cooking as much as they are?
I think so. I don't think it's taken for granted necessarily in that way. It's just... people are just in the moment. It's not about like showing off to like the rest of the world what you're eating. Mm-hmm. I have to like take a photo or it didn't exist. You know, it's like, no, it existed because I ate it. It's now in my stomach and I'm going to go take a nap and it feels good. You know, there's just a different type of joy around the experience as opposed to needing to photograph the experience as a way to like document and somehow like, and call it something, you know?
What about, so both of you, in terms of you moved to America when you were six.
Mm-hmm.
Lau, you were born and raised here.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always, with any immigrants, there's those cultural divides of whatever generation. And there's the scene in the movie where your character is getting at it with your mom. And your mom goes like, well, what are you going to do here? You don't even cook or clean. How can you like come back to China? Is that in your own life? What is that like in terms of, like, do you cook? Did you learn to cook from your mom? Or were you like going to go do your own thing and get into filmmaking and writing and whatnot?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't really like to cook or clean or anything. And my dad, when I was little, used to just be like, walk by my room and be like, your room is so messy. If you can't clean, what kind of man is going to want to marry you? And I'd be like, that's sexist. You know, he's going to clean my room. I'm going to marry someone. And he's like, good luck. And, you know, and we'd just like argue about that. And then my brother, who's a lot younger than me, he was born and raised in the States. He got really into cooking because he would watch these like food shows when he was growing up, is when, like, you know, chefs, not Chef's Table, but the
Iron
Gordon
Chef
Ramsay.
And
yeah.
Master Chef and all those.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He would like Hell's Kitchen. Like he would watch all these shows. And then he got really into like the food that my mom was making. And he was like a picky eater as a kid. He only wanted McDonald's and all this stuff. And I was the really adventurous eater. And I kind of forced him into food because. For his 11th birthday, we took him to this really fancy Japanese restaurant, and he was crying because he just wanted McDonald's. And I took like a piece of ikura, like sushi, and just like shoved it in his mouth, and was like, "How can you say you don't like when you don't even try?" And I force fed it to him, and then he was like, in between tears, was like, "Can I have another
one?" Pretty good. Yeah. Pretty good. Can I get?
Yeah.
Sounds like my 11-year-old.
That's how he became like interested in food. He'll tell that story.
And now he's a sous chef. Right?
And now he's a sous chef at Auburn in LA.
Oh, awesome.
At 25 years old, he dropped out of college when he was 19 to become a sous chef, or to become a chef, and he worked his way, you know, up through all of these different restaurants. So. You know, the expectations are so, like, I think my parents were just kind of old school. And my dad is like, you're a woman, you should cook and you should, you know. And then when my brother got into food, he was just like, why is my son in the kitchen like all the time?
Welcome,
like,
to America.
Not,
yeah,
exactly.
So do you cook at all now?
I cook all the time. Uh-huh. My brother will even say I'm above average.
Wow, for
a home cook, you know.
But do you, what sort of food do you cook typically?
I like roasts, you know, because it's easy, like, and I'm pretty good at them. Like, I'll do ossobuco, but I cook everything. Like, I make pasta, I'll do steak on the grill. I love to do a really classic roast chicken.
But have you gone to your mom and asked her to teach you the dishes that you grew up eating that she would make?
I know the really simple ones. I know, like, noodles and things. But my brother knows, now that he's a professional chef, he's basically gotten all of her recipes, and he's really learned. Because some of the stuff that takes technique, it's just too much work.
Yeah.
It's, like, too much, like, dicing and chopping, and I don't have time for that.
Yeah, if you do it every day, then it becomes... wrote, but if you're doing it for the first time, it's a major undertaking.
Just have your brother make it for you.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm like, I have Anthony.
Wait,
he does it.
So, Lau, we know you like to eat. We know you like to take pictures. I don't think I've ever seen a picture of anything that you yourself have actually cooked.
I have something to admit.
Yes.
For the first time on this podcast, I've shot probably hundreds, maybe thousands of Bon Appetit recipes. I've never made one.
Never one.
Not a
single
one.
Do you cook at all?
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't cook with recipes. If I see like a nice chicken and like produce, I'm like, I will make something and put it in the oven and roast it. Or
see that my brother would go off about this. Like he says that's the important thing. Like recipes are great, but you need to. Every home cook should have the basic knowledge of like how to roast a chicken.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like how does heat work with oil?
Exactly. If you understand technique, which is the whole basis of Samin Nosrat's book. I don't want to say you can cook anything, but you can cook most things, and you understand why that dish tastes the way it does, and you can then sort of riff on your own sort of accord. But I don't think I've – I mean, I don't think I've – literally on your Instagram, which is – what is it? Young Blood Lau?
Yeah.
Y-U-N-G.
Yeah.
I don't think you've ever shot any dishes that – you don't share food photos typically that you yourself cook, do you?
No. I think it's – like sometimes I'll think about it, but I think it's – I spend – so much of my life shooting food.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to do is shoot food in my free time. No, but I do like shooting. I sometimes do need to hit up my parents or my mother to teach me how to make recipes. Although, honestly, I think she's gotten I hope she's not listening to this. I think she's gotten worse at cooking.
Your mom?
Yeah.
You just said this on air.
She's not going to listen to this.
Yes, she is, but I send it to her.
Don't send it to her.
Lau's mom came into the test kitchen a few years ago to do a whole soup dumpling demo
that
for us.
That doesn't count.
Why do you think she's gotten worse, though?
Because she doesn't have practice. Because me and my brothers don't live in California anymore. She is good, but like when she did a story with Bon Appetit, she freaked. I don't know if I told you this either. She freaked out and was so nervous. She practiced cooking it every day.
Oh my God,
she was like testing recipe and like asking all her chef friends and like in her home and just like sending me reference photos. I think she's a good chef, but I think like, you know, if you don't have practice, you can't.
I would
good.
Say this, like I do, just from my own experience, like I'm not as nearly like as sort of adventurous or exhaustive of a home cook as some people at BA, but I do have like my mom's go-to sort of Jewish recipes, like her version of latkes, chopped liver, brisket, macaroons and stuff, and I literally have them like on note cards, handwritten down, and it's very cool to have those, cook them for your people, pass them on, and you don't need to know everything that your mom or grandmother cooked, but just to have a handful of sort of staples is really worthwhile, I would say.
The tricky part is that I'm sure your parents are the same. Nobody uses recipes,
exactly. So
I have to be there.
I have to have a day and like maybe audio record something and like write everything.
But
down.
Even when I do that, they're like, you know. More or less.
Something like
soy
that.
Sauce. Something like this.
I'm
more
like,
or less.
What does
and
that mean?
I'm like, a cup and a half. She's like, it doesn't really matter. And this is where my brother gets really mad because he's a professional chef. And then he'll eat one of my mom's dishes and then say, like, Mom, you're being lazy. And she was like, yeah. I'm like, and he's like, no, last time you did this and you can make it better if you just did this. And she's like, but that's so much work.
Exactly.
So they'll argue about it, you know, because he now wants to do everything like perfectly in an elevated way. And she's just like, yeah, it's fine.
I mean, that's literally his job, but your mom, that's not her job.
Exactly.
I always had this sort of discussion with the test kitchen editors at Bon Appetit in terms of when they're developing recipes and adding, like, being so refined with all of the every single step. And it's like, well, you're in a test kitchen all day with every ingredient and tool at your disposal, and this is your job to do.
Yeah.
When people are at home, they've got all these other things going on. They're probably not going to want to jump through every single hoop that you prescribe. So can we remove a few hoops?
Yeah, and honestly, sometimes I get tired of perfection, you know? That's why, like, home cooking tastes so good, because it's just love and heart, you know? They just kind of go, there's a sprinkle, a dash of this and a dash of that, and they're tasting as they go along, as opposed to, like, building it around, a standard recipe.
With the film, who, when you were making it and editing it, who ultimately did you think the audience would be for the film? Who do you think it would appeal most to, and how far could it spread as a, you know, smaller independent film?
You know, I honestly didn't think about it, because I feel like it was it's just a tricky thing. Once I think about it, it might limit, you know, how I approach the film, because when I first wanted to make the film and I started pitching it, people kept saying, well, is it for an American audience? Is it for a Chinese audience?
But I'm sure investors always want to know that, right?
Yeah, in the beginning. And then I said, well, I'm American and the main character's American. It's about an American perspective into the Chinese culture, so I guess it's for Americans. But then it's subtitled, so are people going to want to watch a subtitle movie? In America, I don't know. Like, I think so. I would. But I'm also not your mainstream audience. So it's hard for me to really answer that question, and I just had to kind of make the best movie that would make me feel something and make me – that felt personal, you know, and hope that translates to a wider audience, but it's really difficult to know.
Yeah, did that occur to you, Lau, at all when you were watching it, like who else would be watching this and would Americans get it or that sort of thing?
Absolutely. I think I don't want to speak on both perhaps, but I think if you're an Asian American creative – literally any time you're creating something like remotely like personal or, you know, a kind of attached to your culture, you're like worried about like crossing the line between like, okay, am I doing this and like, will this only excite Chinese people or will this only excite Asian Americans, or will this only excite white people? And it's where, and you know, you obviously want to get everybody on board. And I don't know. I've watching The Farewell, it honestly didn't feel Chinese, like mainland Chinese or like Asian American to me. It just felt like an all-encompassing like spirit and like story. And I love Crazy Rich Asians. It was great. I'm glad it came out. It's a very unrelatable story because I'm not a super Crazy Rich Asian. This was probably the first time where I saw a movie where I saw a face that not only looked like me, but I could, like, was me. Like, this is my story. And I think that, yeah, it was... I think you just kind of hit all the bases. And like another thing, like honestly, whenever I saw this movie twice, when I was in the theaters, it's mostly not Asian people, which is like, you know, obviously I want all Asian people to see it, but like that's also a testament to like it's not a niche movie, you know. So
yeah. I think it's, I mean, it felt like a personal movie.
Yeah,
and I think personal movies in any culture, if there's like some genuine emotion and struggle and challenge, I think any human being's going to relate to that. And then, but it's interesting that your point, like some of it's subtitled, some of it's in English, goes back from New York to China and back. And yeah, you kind of, it is interesting. I'm watching it. I'm trying to like, okay, where am I? But does it matter? And I guess I was looking at it more from a critical standpoint because I know I was doing this interview. But yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about. I imagine as you were editing the film and whatnot, sort of which way to lean, more this way or that way.
Yeah, and I just really didn't think in that way because I have, you know, I have Asian friends, Asian American friends. I have my family who's Chinese, Chinese American, and then I have a lot of white friends and just non-Asian friends as well. And so when I hang out with them, it's not like they don't get me because they don't understand every part of my culture. Like we relate on so many other levels just as human beings. And so I think that it was important for me to like take a really centered approach to making the film by saying like, this is a story about family and about what is the right thing to do and how do you say goodbye to someone. And I'm not going to approach it as like an outsider, you know, and looking in, but as like just as a person going through this experience. And what people are going to connect to is the story itself, the ethical question itself. And really, Billy is a conduit for the audience because she, as an American, she thinks this is wrong. But we kind of see her journey as she's trying to like navigate these questions. But all of the details, those are backdrop. It's a really important part of the movie. But it's not a movie about identity necessarily from an aesthetic perspective. It's like, you know, how does it feel when you look Asian? Like, that's not what it's about. It's about identity from like, you know, guilt, from like regret of leaving, about immigration. And so like all of the textures had to be really authentic, and I had to fight for that because it was just easier. It's like, I know how to make that film if it's real. If you're telling me, like, for example, one of the notes I actually got was like, there's just too many eating scenes, you know? They were like, there's too many food scenes. And I was like, yeah, but that's
the
reality.
Who said that? Who's complaining about that?
Well, my producers said that only because they were like, it's very repetitive, you know? And I was like, I know, exactly. It's very repetitive. That's the point.
But that's how you get people together is around a table.
Right, it's real. And but they were worried because we're going all the way to China, you know, and we're just... Every single scene is around a table, and like you don't see why don't we have them go take a walk in the park? Like, let's take advantage of the production value of being in China. And I was like, 12 people walking through a park when grandma's dying and they're planning a wedding. Like, how would I do that? Like, how I don't know how to motivate the characters to go do
that.
And
no one actually does that.
No.
Right.
Yeah. That's the point.
Maybe like, you go for a walk with your wife or husband or kid, but no one's like, you're not getting 12 people to do anything together typically other than eat.
Exactly. Like, I don't know, like, how I literally wouldn't know how to write that. Because even for me, if like my dad was like, let's go take a walk, which, by the way, he would never do that. But if he did, I would be like, no.
Yeah.
Like, we're here for 3 days. I want to spend my time with grandma, you know? So it was details like that that I had to fight for the authenticity, because it's like, I can make that scene. I know how to shoot it. I know how to write it. I know how to cast it. I know how to direct actors. But if you tell me to like go do this idea of what you think people should be doing, like, I'm at a loss.
But like, you really hit the nail on the head on like what a family trip in the case of like a sick relative to China is like. You're not going around to street markets and walking around to like, you didn't really see much of, where did you film?
Changchun.
Yeah, you didn't really see much of Changchun. It's like, you were at the hospital, you were at grandma's house, and you went to the cemetery to visit grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
And these are really the three spots that I go to when I'm, if I'm, when I went to Hong Kong and my grandmother was sick, this is all we saw.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you, Lau did a great story for us in our May travel issue this year on Taipei, like 72 hours in Taipei. Mm-hmm. And you hit up every single market and restaurant and this and that, but that was because you were literally working. And
I have never lived a trip like that when going to visit my relatives.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah. I mean, typically when you visit your relatives, most time, and no matter whether your relatives live in Miami or Buffalo or Hong Kong, it's like you spend most of the time in a living room,
yep,
sitting around, and then you migrate to the dining room table, and then you migrate back to the sofa.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, that's it. And then occasionally you might go somewhere. But, yeah, you're not going exploring and checking out the cool new restaurants.
But that's the same as, like, you know, what I was saying earlier about the food. When you're telling this a personal story like this, it's like you're not exoticizing any of it, not the locations, not the food.
Yeah.
And that was the challenge, was like, how do we make a living room have an aesthetic? Like, how do we make this very small room with white walls and mismatching art and furniture and an overhead fluorescent light, because that's the authentic lighting.
That specific color
is
like all over China. That specific light,
like blue-green.
Like, it kind of, like, washes you out, but, like, they love it. And if you don't have that light on, if you just have, like, a dim, warm tungsten light, they'd be like, why is it so dark? Are you guys going broke? Is that why you can't, like, use the electricity?
Oh, my God. All right, Lou, before we let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Let's just say you and your boyfriend get engaged, okay? Are you having a big Chinese banquet wedding, or are you getting married on your friend's, like, house in Malibu up on in some lawn somewhere?
I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, my extended family, my grandma and all those people, so depending on who's around, but, like, my parents don't care about that stuff, really, and, like, I don't care about that stuff. It's a lot. Like, it's like a production, and, like, I work in.
It's like a movie.
And I'm just like, I don't want to put on a show for anybody. It's like, you can never really enjoy it if you're hosting something like that, because you're not in it. You're trying to take care of everyone else. So I don't know. My dream would just be to, like, elope maybe and, like, on a beach somewhere. I don't know.
All right, final question.
Pasadena City Hall.
Yeah. Final question: crab or lobster?
Crab. I actually like crab more.
We figured it out. We nailed it.
Alex Lau, Lou Luong, thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks so much to Lulu and Alex. And now, here is Amanda chatting about corn and tomatoes and cucumber and peaches and eggplant and all the things you should absolutely, definitely be cooking with right now. Okay, so Amanda.
Yes.
First question.
Yes.
Is it really a challenge?
It depends on how ambitious you want to be.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I think for people who are already cooking a lot, cooking with these ingredients is not really a challenge. It's just, like, a fun thing to work into your normal routine. If you're not really, like, as comfortable, if you don't go to the farmer's market as often, and you want to, this is sort of like a kick in the butt to get you to get you moving in August, which is, like, the best time to cook, I would say.
Even though heat is required, but you're saying the ingredients are, like, the most abundant and ripe and plenty.
Yes, I know this is a controversial thing to say, but when I talk about cooking in August, I don't mean you're spending very long in the kitchen. That's actually what makes it such a great time to cook, is because so many of these ingredients need so little to taste amazing.
So this is the second year of the Farmers Market Challenge on our Healthy-ish site. The original premise was what, in terms of structuring it and how you wanted to present this to the user/reader?
Yeah, so unlike our Feel Good Food Plan, which is our January challenge that happens over the course of 10 days, 10 recipes in a row, this is 10 recipes over the course of a month. So it's a little looser. We're not necessarily saying you have to cook them in order, which you don't have to do with the Feel Good Food Plan either, but it's really more about giving you the opportunity to highlight some of the best produce around in the market right now over the course of the month.
Okay, so, like, yeah, what's really, quote unquote, popping right now? And, like, I mean, I will say this, like, there are times where I'll go to the farmer's market and I see, like, oh my God, there's so much, like, amazing eggplant, like Japanese eggplant, those round ones and the big ones. And I'm like, I feel like I should buy them. But then I'm like, what's the best thing to do with them? And then I don't know. Then I'm just randomly searching the internet for 7,000 recipes.
Yeah. So our challenge, I think, is a great mix of certain ingredients that are definitely all stars. Like, nobody has to tell you what to do with tomatoes, right? Like, you know a million ways that you're going to love to eat a delicious heirloom tomato, starting with just like on its own with like a little salt or on toast or in pasta or this or that. So those ones are just ones we know people love. We're going to give you in our challenge here, we have a spaghetti with no cook puttanesca sauce. It was also in the August Bon Appetit issue, and it's so good, so easy. But then there are other ingredients like, say, red peppers. Like, you might not think of those as a seasonal ingredient, but they're all hitting the markets right now, and they're really, really just fresh and crisp and delicious. And so for that one, we did a roasted red pepper frittata.
Oh, yeah.
Also from the issue, from the August issue. And that one, you know, you cook them down. They get really roasty and delicious and soft, and then you cook.
Jammy.
Yes, jammy, one might say. And then you put them in a frittata, which might not be the thing that you'd think to combine, to put in with
so, red peppers. Yeah, so structurally, there's 10 categories. Each category is an ingredient. So we've got summer squash, peaches, corn, mint, fresh mint, peppers, dance break. I see that in the middle of the package online. We can get back to that in a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Eggplant, cucumbers, tomatoes, Swiss chard, and then berries. And for each ingredient gets one recipe, a few of which you've mentioned already. If we can just run through them, and then I would like to know which ones you yourself have been cooking and digging on particularly.
Yes.
So I'm going to read like the menu. So we have homemade hummus.
We are store-bought? Yes. Well, you can use store bought if you want to cheat. I will admit that I cheated and I got hummus, but I got it from Damascus, which is the delicious Middle Eastern grocer in New York City. So I didn't feel so bad about it. You don't have to make your own hummus for it. You can.
That is with spiced summer squash and ground crispy lamb. This one's gorgeous. I've seen this on the internet, on the Instagram. Cucumber and peach salad with fresh herbs. A coconut creamed corn and grains with crispy shallots.
It's actually vegan.
Minty limeade, which I remember in the test kitchen, I was disagreeing with Andy Baragani about how limey it should be. We can get to that in a second. We got your roasted red pepper frittata, stir-fried eggplant with basil and chilies. That looks gorgeous. And there's a little ground pork in that one also, right?
Yeah, there is. And you can use ground pork. You can use ground chicken. You can even use crumbled tempeh or tofu if you want to make it vegetarian.
And I think what's interesting about Healthy-ish in general as a site is that it's vegetable forward, but not vegetarian necessarily. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and we like to give people options too. So like if we are going to include meat, we like to have some kind of idea for an alternative if you don't want to use meat.
Cool. Napa cabbage with cucumber slaw. I've been big into Napa cabbage lately, just making up any and every kind of slaw. You mentioned the spaghetti with no cook puttanesca. Herb jam. What is an herb jam?
All right. So this one, the ingredient we're highlighting is Swiss chard, because you do want to use a pound of a hearty green, like either Swiss chard or spinach, mature spinach, not the baby kind. But then you also add in, I think it's like 3 cups of herbs. And what you do is you combine them all and you really cook them down until they are really pretty jammy. And then you add a little bit of aromatics. And then what you end up getting is sort of this savory spread that you're going to want to eat on toast with like either a little bit of ricotta or whipped feta. It's a delicious breakfast. It could work as lunch. It's just like a all-purpose toast of the summer, I would say.
Could put an egg on it, perhaps?
You would definitely want to put an egg on this, yes.
And then finally, strawberry raspberry fools, which is basically macerated fruit with a lot of whipped cream. Okay, so here's the deal, Amanda. I know you love all your children equally, but you get to pick 3 of these recipes that you take with you, and the other like 7 have to walk the plank or something. Like, what are the 3 from the Farmers Market Challenge 2019 that are your favorites?
Okay. I'm going to go in order. There's no order, actually. There's no order of preference here. These are all 3 of my triplet favorites.
Equally favorite. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Number 1. And I'm not saying this because it's also number 1 in the challenge, but the hummus with the summer squash and lamb is amazing.
So talk us through that one.
So this recipe actually came from Deb Perlman, you might know of Smitten Kitchen and BA print contributor.
She has a column in the magazine called The Picky Eaters Club, in which she writes about cooking for her own kids who can be a little picky.
Right. And so this recipe, we just saw it and we thought this is too perfect for the Farmers Market Challenge because it's easy, it's, you know, comes together quickly, and it highlights summer squash. And it does what we just said, which is it uses a little bit of meat as flavoring, as kind of a component of it, but it's not the main focus of the dish. It's really about the summer squash and the hummus, and you know, you want to get some pita to scoop it into. It's just a really fun thing to eat.
So summer squash can be yellow squash, kind of zucchini. Also, mm-hmm. what are you doing with the summer squash?
So you're doing a pretty hard cook on the summer squash. As opposed to last year's Farmers Market Challenge, our squash recipe was this basil squash pasta that you really cook it down until it gets really jammy.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yes, that's a great one.
Yeah.
So in contrast, this year's is you do a pretty hard, fast saute. Like, it's only in the pan for like 3 or 4 minutes, and it's covered in lots of really aromatic, strong spices, coriander, red pepper flakes, and so it gets really coated in that. And then you take that out, and you I think it's actually frying in the leftover like lamb oil if you choose to use the ground lamb.
Gotcha.
So it's super flavorful, super kind of crisp on the outside, tender on the inside.
Yeah. And then, like I said, serve those some warm pita bread.
Mm-hmm.
And you can either make the hummus yourself or store-bought.
Yep, totally easy.
Love that.
My next favorite child is definitely the stir-fried eggplant. I actually made that last night. And I know I picked the two with meat, but I actually made the eggplant last night, and I did it instead of ground pork. I just cooked some whole salmon fillets in the pan after I did the eggplant.
When you say did the eggplant, what does that mean?
So the eggplant, I used fairy tales, which are these really tiny kind of baby eggplants that only come around this season, but you can use any kind of long, skinny one, like Japanese or Chinese eggplants. There's even those Italian kind of heirloom ones that are really kind of speckly and pretty.
But you don't want like the big sort of eggplant parm ones necessarily.
I wouldn't. If you use those, I mean, I'm not the expert, but I would want to like salt them and squeeze them a little bit so you don't get the bitterness. And so they might need to cook a little longer. But these fairy tale ones are these long, skinny ones. They cook so fast and they get kind of creamy on the outside without totally falling apart.
Yep.
So those go in the pan just long enough. It's a super hot pan, just long enough to get kind of like a sear on both sides, get that creaminess in the middle. Then you're going to take them out of the pan, put them on a plate, and then you do your ground pork if that's what you're using. Or what I did was just did some seared crispy skinned salmon fillets, took them off, and then you have this glaze that you're making. It's got honey in it, it's got crushed red pepper flakes, it's got rice wine vinegar, it's got soy sauce in it. It's so flavorful, and that honey is going to really thicken and caramelize the glaze. So you throw that back in the pan with the eggplant. I threw the salmon back in there, kind of broke it up, and just tossed everything together. And it wasn't as beautiful as it could have been, perhaps.
Yeah, the picture on Healthyish at BeHealthyish.com is gorgeous. You see that purple skin of the eggplants and all caramelized. But I also think what you mentioned about the glaze, like, it has all those components. It has a sweet element in the honey. It has the acid in the rice wine vinegar, and it has the salty in the soy.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's got some spice.
And some spice, and it kind of gives you everything you need in a sort of a glaze. And I'm sure if you didn't have honey, you could use maybe agave or something. As long as you have those components is what you're looking for.
Yes, and this recipe actually reminds me a lot of one from last year. So you throw in, a handful, pretty big handful of basil into this one. And cooked basil, like just gently cooked in a really kind of spicy, flavorful, slightly sweet sauce like that is just so delicious. And I realized this last year when we did our shrimp and basil stir fry, which was basil was one of our ingredients in the Farmers Market Challenge last year. And that basil and shrimp stir fry, I remember, like, that was one of the most popular recipes. People still make it all the time. I think it ended up in one of the issues just because it's so easy, and that flavor combination is just like magic.
Yeah, I think just that just quickly cooked through, so it's super fragrant. You get that in Thai food a lot, where it's just you have basil as not just as an accent, but as a main ingredient.
Yeah.
All right, I'm really hungry now. All right, we got one more.
You want my third favorite child? Okay, so that has to be. Okay, I haven't made them all yet in my defense, but I would say of the ones I've made, the spaghetti with no cooked puttanesca, and this is like pretty a big deal for me to say because I love our no cook tomato sauce recipe, and it has a lot of the same ingredients. It comes together really fast, but this one I think actually might win out over that one on basically because this one adds, I mean, it's the puttanesca, right? So you have the capers, you have the olives, you have just like a hint, like a little bit more complexity than just, you know, tomatoes, garlic. And the fact that you're using kind of both heirloom tomatoes or whole like beefsteak tomatoes that you're blending, and then you're adding cherry tomatoes to that, I think is really it's just kind of a really smart way to get the two textures of tomatoes combined into one dish.
Yeah, I think what's fun about this also, so if you're like and what's unique about this at the farmer's market is that, like, this time of year, you can also go and buy a bunch of different types of little tomatoes. Like, they have the sun golds and the regular cherry and the grape tomatoes, and some are yellow and some are orange and some are red. And you can oftentimes, at a lot of good stands, they kind of all cost the same. So you can mix and match a bag.
Yeah.
And that's really fun, even little green tomatoes. And you can then make this sauce that you've got all these, like, little pops of color.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, visually, and they all taste a little different. The visual is really nice.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I love about going to the farmer's market now, is that abundance of so many different types of the same thing, but all a little different.
Right. Like I was saying with the eggplant, you don't have to use the one exact type that we call for. Like, see what looks fresh at the market, see what's appealing to you, and just, like, go with it. And it's probably going to be delicious, because that's what things taste like this time of year.
Okay. So you can find all these recipes at BeHealthyish.com under the Farmers Market Challenge. And are we people sharing recipes, Amanda?
Yeah, so you can go on Instagram. We're posting all the recipes over the course of the month, and we're asking people if you cook a recipe to post it and tag Healthyish and do hashtag Farmers Market Challenge so that we can see and regram and share.
Awesome. Thank you, Amanda.
Yeah.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.